emailed her friend because I'd been distressed about how quickly she and Dave had committed to each other. I could see the tension cross her face as I informed her that two of her best friends had been discussing her. I could understand why it made her feel defensive and uncomfortable. Who were we to weigh in on the subject of who she married and how fast? I understood that completely. But I also understood who it was we were. We were two of her best friends. We were the people who listened to her tell all those awful and glorious stories about Tom. And we would be the people who would be there for her regardless of how things turned out with Dave. We would be her friends no matter what, because we loved her. If she needed us, we would go to her anytime. We would stand by her. She knew this, and I knew the same about her. I knew she'd always tell me the truth, even if it hurt. And I also knew that she'd take care not to hurt me. I knew over the course of our friendship, she too might have opinions or concerns about me that she'd opt to discuss with someone else in words that would be best for me not to hear. And I knew that was okay, that it was a perfectly natural part of sustaining a true friendship over many years, that it wasn't a betrayal, but a blessing. That's what you have in these men, Odd Man Out. True friends. Real blessings. Forgive them. Feel lucky you have them. Move along. Yours, Sugar. Icky thoughts turn me on. Dear Sugar, I'm a straight woman, soon to be 34. Icky thoughts turn me on. Thoughts about father-daughter incest, or men taking me aggressively, and my being submissive in bed. I've always tried to push these thoughts away because they're out of line with who I am, and also because they're repulsive and embarrassing. But I usually can't help myself, and my mind wanders there anyway. They are essentially the way I get myself off. I'm a strong, independent, normal, feminist-minded woman who is, of course, against rape and incest and male domination, so I feel more than terrible that I have these thoughts, and yet I can't seem to stop them. I've had 3 serious boyfriends over the years, and a few shorter-term dating partners and lovers, and recently I've started seeing a man I like a lot. With some of these men, I've had a tiny bit of sexual power play, but I've never revealed the full extent of my desires and fantasies to anyone. I think one reason I feel so ashamed is that my father was mildly sexually abusive to me early on in my life, i.e. light fondling off and on for about a year. He died in a car accident when I was 8, so it didn't go on very long, thank God, but I worry that my sick thoughts go back to him and what he did, especially because daddy-daughter fantasies play rather prominently in my mind, which makes me want to puke. I'm writing to ask what you would do if you were me, Sugar. Should I give way to my sick thoughts, or should I fight them off? I know people do lots of kinky things, but I have zero interest in getting involved with an S&M community. That stuff is way too heavy for my taste anyway. I'm not into any sort of power imbalance outside the bedroom, and I'm not a masochist in the slightest. I don't want a dungeon or a whip, or to be anyone's slave. I just yearn to be lovingly but firmly dominated in bed, in ways that are almost exclusively psychological, conversational, and nothing beyond tenderly firm when it comes to the physical aspects. I feel like I either need to purge these fantasies for good or fully embrace them so that I have a more fulfilled sex life. What would you do? How would you do it? Do you think I could ever risk sharing this with a man, or would he think I was a sicko and run away? Aching to submit. Dear Aching to Submit, did you ever play that game as a kid where you'd go into a dark bathroom and stare at your shadowy reflection in the mirror and repeat, Mary Worth, Mary Worth, Mary Worth, 13 times? The legend in my neck of the woods had it that by the time you spoke that last Mary Worth, the mirror would crack and drip with blood, and quite possibly Mary Worth herself would appear. I remembered that game when I read your heartbreaking letter, Aching to Submit. I know it's corny, but I'd like you to play your own version of the Mary Worth game with me. Step into the bathroom and gaze at your reflection in the mirror and repeat this sentence to yourself 13 times. But let's leave on the lights. Icky thoughts turn me on. 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 Did the mirror crack and drip with blood? Did any scary faces appear? Did you run shrieking from the room? I hope your answer is no. I hope you stood right there and met your own gaze. Every agonizing bit of self-loathing in your letter and every conundrum you pose will be soothed and solved by your ability to do so, sweet pea. Of course you're not a sicko because icky thoughts turn you on. You aren't even weird. Do you know how many women have these same fantasies? Invite your best girlfriends over and do a little I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours. Pick up any book that has the words women and erotic in the subtitle and thumb your way through a veritable feast of spankings and bossy brutes, big daddies and naughty little girls. You can be a, quote, strong, independent, normal, feminist-minded woman and still want this crazy shit in bed. In fact, being a strong, independent, normal, feminist-minded woman only increases your chance of getting what you want from sex. So let's talk about how you can do that, my submissive little plum. It's clear to me that you have some healing to do in regards to your father. He sexually abused you, and then he died. That's big, hard stuff. A good psychotherapist will help you make sense of your loss, your violation, and the love you likely still have for your dad. He or she will also help you explore how your history is connected to your current sexual desires. My guess is that it is connected, at least murkily, as uncomfortable as that makes you feel. But that doesn't mean you wanted your father to fuck you, or that you would like to be raped or bullied by men. It means perhaps that you lost something or were wounded in a place that your sexual longings are maybe, and only maybe, attempting to recover and repair. It's impossible to know, but I encourage you to seek as much insight into your own shadow world as you can. Not so you'll rid yourself of your, quote, sick thoughts, but so you can finally embrace your sexuality and have some fun. And fun it is. The deal with sexual fantasy is that it's pretend. And when a fantasy is acted out, it's done so between and among consenting adults. There's a world of difference between being raped and asking someone to rip your clothes off and fuck you. You are the agent of power in your sex life, even if what you want is to relinquish your power and agency while you're having sex. You can take that power back at any moment. Which means, of course, that you always had it. Rape victims don't. Incest victims don't. Victims of domineering bullies don't. You're missing this key point when you lambast yourself for having the desires that you do, when you reject the reality that icky thoughts turn you on. The ickiest part of each of these acts is that someone is being hurt because he or she is being forced to do what he or she does not want to do. You want the opposite. You want someone to do what you want him to do. And once you understand this distinction, you'll stop feeling so horrible about your desires, and you'll start asking the men in your life to help you fulfill them. It will be good, hot, beautiful fun. It will also be a little bit scary, the way it always is when we're brave enough to touch the rawest, realest truths. When we have the guts to look directly into the mirror and say Mary Worth 13 times without pause, and see, thrillingly, terrifyingly, that it was never her we had to fear. It was always only us. Yours, Sugar. Reach. Dear Sugar, I was raised in the very conservative Christian Deep South, where I've discovered that my life has been sheltered from the views and lifestyles in other areas of the country. Our town has a population of about 6,000. The whole county has less than 30,000. I know that people are pretty much the same everywhere, but in the South, people tend to keep things out of the public eye. I'm a professional in a real estate-related field, and I own my own business. I've been married for 20-plus years and have 4 children. The first half of my marriage was what I consider utopia, but we've grown apart over the last 10 years or so. Now it seems that we simply cohabitate peacefully, similar to siblings. Neither of us is happy, but we stay together for the kids. Several years ago, I was involved in an accident that damaged my spine. I was told by a neurosurgeon that operating wouldn't help, and he referred me to a pain management clinic. Now I am hopelessly addicted to the pain meds. In my youth, I experimented with drinking and drugs. Much of that was spurred on by the suicide of an older sibling. I never had a problem as far as addiction, though. Now I take a month's supply of some very strong pain meds in about 7 to 10 days. Then I crash and have to beg or borrow from others to make it to the next appointment. I know that these drugs will end up turning my liver into a rock if I don't accidentally overdose first. I know that I have a serious problem. When the economy went bad, so did business, and we ended up losing our health insurance. I no longer have employees, so if I don't work every day, we don't eat. Rehab is realistically impossible. I can't depend on my wife for support and don't have any other family anywhere close. I feel totally alone, except for my children. I tried everything I could think of, from prayer to cold turkey. I simply don't have the discipline to follow through. I've come to depend on the drugs mentally, as much or more than physically. I depend on the drugs to help me deal with the lack of work and income, as well as dealing with a loveless marriage. Couple that with the loss of my dear mother 1.5 years ago, and soon thereafter one of my best friends to cancer. Now I have begun to have problems with depression and suicidal thoughts that I'm sure are related to the meds as much as the economy or anything else. The choices I see are, 1, continue like I have been, knowing that there is a good chance that it will kill me. 2, find a way to go to rehab and lose the house and business. My wife doesn't work. 3, go to AA or NA meetings in this small town. This would almost surely ruin what's left of my business. I hope you can see some other options, because I just don't see any of the ones I've listed working out. Please be honest, blunt, and give me a new perspective on my multifaceted problem. Thank you, Ruler of a Fallen Empire. Dear Ruler of a Fallen Empire, I'm terribly sorry for your misfortune. You listed the 3 options you believe you have, but really they all say the same thing, that you believe you're fucked before you begin. I understand why you feel this way. Your convergence of physical pain, drug addiction, financial woe, no health insurance, and an unhappy marriage is truly daunting. But you don't have the luxury of despair. You can find a way to overcome these difficulties, and you must. There aren't 3 options. There is only 1. As Rilke says, you must change your life. You have the capacity to do that, Ruler. It seems impossible now, but you aren't thinking clearly. The drugs and desperation and depression have muddled your head. If there is only 1 thought that you hold in your mind right now, please let it be that one. It was that thought that got me out of my own drug, money, love disaster several years ago. Someone I trusted told me what to do when I couldn't think right for myself, and listening to him saved my life. You say that you don't have the, quote, discipline to follow through when it comes to kicking your addiction, but you do. It's that you can't do it alone. You need to reach out for help. Here's what I think you should do. 1, talk to a medical doctor at your pain management clinic and tell him or her that you've become addicted to your pain medication, and also that you're depressed and broke. Tell the whole story. Don't conceal anything. You aren't alone. You have nothing to be ashamed of. I know your first instinct is to lie to your doctor, lest he or she cut off your drug supply. But don't trust that instinct. That's the instinct that will ruin your life and possibly kill you. Trust the man inside you, who you really are. And if you can't do that, trust me. Your doctor can help you safely taper off the drug to which you've become addicted, prescribe an alternative non-addictive drug, refer you to drug addiction treatment programs and/or psychological counseling, or all of the above. 2. Perhaps your doctor knows of a drug treatment program available to you at no cost. But if this isn't an option, I implore you to attend a Narcotics Anonymous NA meeting or an Alcoholics Anonymous AA meeting if that's what's available in your town. Of course you're afraid of being judged and condemned. Some people will judge and condemn you, but most won't. Our minds are small, but our hearts are big. Just about every one of us has fucked up at one point or another. You're in a pickle. You did things you didn't hope to do. You have not always been your best self. This means that you're like the rest of us. I've never been in a humiliating situation when I wasn't shocked by all the, quote, normal people who were also in the very same humiliating position. Humans are beautifully imperfect and complex. We're horny, ass-saving, ego-driven drug fiends, among other more noble things. I think you'll be comforted when you go to the AA-NA meeting and see how many have problems similar to yours, including people you assumed would not. Those people will help you heal yourself, darling. They'll support you as you face this addiction, and they'll do it for free. I know a lot of people who have transformed their lives thanks to those meetings. None of them thought they were the AANA type before they went. They knew that they were smarter, or more sophisticated, or less religious, or more skeptical, or less strung out, or more independent than all those other hopeless freaks who went to AA or NA. They were all wrong. You worry that your business will be ruined if word gets around that you're attending meetings. I think people are more generous than you're imagining. Yes, even in the, quote, very conservative Christian Deep South. But ruler, even if you're right, what's the alternative? Your addiction and depression will only deepen if you continue on this path. Would you rather have your business go down because you refused to make a change in your life, or because you live among a community of punishing jerks who condemned you for seeking help? 3. Talk to your wife and tell her about your addiction and your depression. This might be the first item on the list or the last. I can't gauge from your letter. Will your wife be an important advocate for you as you make the initial reach for help? Or will she be more supportive if you tell her after you've made a few positive changes on your own? Either way, I imagine she'll feel betrayed to learn that you've been concealing your addiction from her, and eventually relieved that she knows the truth. You say your marriage is loveless, and perhaps you're correct that your relationship has come to its natural end. But I'd like you to consider the notion that you aren't the best judge of that right now. You're a psychologically distressed drug addict with 4 kids, no health insurance, uncertain business prospects, and a pile of bills. I wouldn't expect your marriage to be thriving. I doubt you've been an excellent partner in recent years, and it doesn't sound like your wife has either. But that the two of you have managed, after your 10 happy years together, to roll on for another 10 peaceably in spite of the enormous stress you're under is an accomplishment that you mustn't fail to recognize. It may indicate that the love you once shared isn't dead. Perhaps you can rebuild your marriage. Perhaps you can't. Either way, I encourage you to see. 4. Make a financial plan, even if that plan is an anatomy of a disaster. You cite money as the reason you can't go into rehab, or even to AA-NA meetings. But surely you know that the financial repercussions will be far worse if you continue on your present course. Everything is at stake, ruler. Your children, your career, your marriage, your home, your life. If you need to spend some money to cure yourself, so be it. The only way out of a hole is to climb out. After you consult with your doctor and see what options are available to you, and after you have a heart-to-heart with your wife about your situation, sit down with her and have a discussion about money in which everything is on the table. Perhaps you qualify for public assistance. Perhaps your wife can get a job, either temporarily or permanently. Perhaps you can get a loan from a friend or family member. Perhaps things won't seem so dire once you make the first steps in the direction of healing, and you'll be able to maintain your job while you recover. I know you feel panicked about your financial standing because you have 4 children to support, but every choice you're currently making is hurting your cause. The only way for you to support your family financially is to get yourself together. I lived in Brooklyn for several months when I was 24. I shared an apartment with the man who was then my husband, in a building that was mostly empty. Below us, there was a bodega. Above us, a couple who got into raging fights in the middle of the night. The rest of the building, though full of apartments, was unoccupied for reasons that were never clear to me. I spent my days alone writing in the apartment while my husband worked his job as an assistant to a rich friend. In the evenings, I worked as a waitress. "Did you hear something strange?" my husband asked me one night when I got home from work. "Hear something?" I asked. "Behind the walls," he said. "I heard something earlier, and I wondered if you heard it too, while you were alone today." "I didn't hear anything," I said. But the next day I did. Something behind the walls, and then from the ceiling. Something close, then distant, then close again, then gone. I didn't know what it was. It sounded awful, like a baby who was extremely discreet. Its keen had the weight of a feather, the velocity of a dried leaf falling from a tree. It could have been nothing. It could have been me. It was the exact expression of the sound my insides were making every time I thought of my life, and how I needed to change it, and how impossible that seemed. "I heard something," I told my husband that night. He went to the wall and touched it. There was nothing there. It was silent. "I think we're imagining things," he said, and I agreed. But the sound kept coming and going, all through December, impossible to define or reach. Christmas came, and we were all alone. My husband had received a bonus from his friend, and we spent some of it on tickets to the opera in way back seats. It was Mozart's The Magic Flute. "I keep hearing it," I said to my husband on the subway home. "The sound behind the walls?" "Yeah," he said. "Me too." On New Year's Day, we woke at 7 to a yowling. We jumped out of bed. The sound was the same one we'd been hearing for 3 weeks, but it wasn't discreet anymore. It was coming very clearly from the ceiling of our closet. My husband immediately got a hammer and started pounding away at the plaster with the claw end, chipping it in great chalky chunks that fell over our clothes. Within 10 minutes, he'd clawed almost the entire closet ceiling away. We didn't care that we were ruining the place. We knew only that we had to get to the source of that sound, which had stopped during the pounding. Once there was no more closet ceiling to claw away, we went silent and stared up into the mysterious black innards of the building. At first it seemed there was nothing, that the horrible soundmaker had again gone away, or perhaps we really had imagined it. But a moment later, 2 emaciated kittens appeared, coming to peer down at us from the jagged edge of the hole. They were the strangest things I've ever seen. So skeletal they should have been dead, visibly shaking with fear, caked in soot and spiderwebs and globs of black grease, their eyes enormous and blazing. "Meow," one of them said. "Meow," wailed the other. My husband and I held up our palms, and the kittens walked into them immediately. They were so light, it was like holding air with the smallest possible thing in it. They were like 2 sparrows in our hands. I've tried to write about this experience several times over the years. It was an odd thing that happened to me during a sad and uncertain era of my life that I hoped would tell readers something deep about my ex-husband and me, about how in love we were, and also how lost, about how we were like those kittens who'd been trapped and starving for weeks. Or maybe not about the kittens at all. Maybe the meaning was in how we heard the sound, but did nothing about it, until it was so loud we had no choice. I never found a way to write about it until I wrote this letter to you, Ruler, when I realized it was a story you needed to hear. Not how the kittens suffered during those weeks they were wandering inside the dark building with no way out, though surely there's something there, too. But how they saved themselves. How frightened those kittens were, and yet how they persisted. How when 2 strangers offered up their palms, they stepped in. Yours, Sugar. Part 2. Whatever mysterious starlight that guided you this far. I'm often asked these questions about the Dear Sugar column. Number one, are the letters you publish really sent in by anonymous people? Most are so well written that it seems you or the Rumpus writers must be creating them. The letters published in my column and in this book were sent to me by people who sought my advice. In most cases, the name and or email address of the letter writer is not visible to me. I do not write the letters, nor does anyone at the Rumpus. Because I have thousands of letters from which to choose, well-written letters probably have a higher chance of being plucked from the proverbial pile, simply because they're more concise and complex. I agree with you that the letters are lovely. I have even more in my inbox. Number two, do you ever hear from the letter writers after they read the answers you gave them? I'd be interested in knowing what they have to say. I've heard from about half of them. Each has responded warmly, even when my advice brought up difficult emotions. I imagine it's very intense to have your letter published and answered. I feel honored they trusted me to ponder their lives. Number three, you seem so emotionally healthy, but from your column, I can tell you've had your own struggles in the past. Do you ever struggle anymore? Of course. Number four, are you a therapist or have you gone through extensive psychotherapy? I'm not a therapist, and I've only seen a therapist a handful of times in my life, which means, in technical terms, I'm totally unqualified for this gig. The Baby Bird. Dear Sugar, WTF, WTF, WTF. I'm asking this question as it applies to everything, every day. Best, WTF. Dear WTF, my father's father made me jack him off when I was 3 and 4 and 5. I wasn't any good at it. My hands were too small, and I couldn't get the rhythm right, and I didn't understand what I was doing. I only knew I didn't want to do it, knew that it made me feel miserable and anxious in a way so sickeningly particular that I can feel that same particular sickness rising this very minute in my throat. I hated having to rub my grandfather's cock, but there was nothing I could do. I had to do it. My grandfather babysat my sister and me a couple times a week in that era of my life, and most of the days that I was trapped in his house with him, he would pull his already getting hard penis out of his pants and say, "Come here," and that was that. I moved far away from him when I was nearly 6, and soon after that, my parents split up, and my father left my life, and I never saw my grandfather again. He died of black lung disease when he was 66 and I was 15. When I learned he died, I wasn't sad. I wasn't happy either. He was no one to me, and yet he was always there. The force of him and what he'd made me do moving through me like a dark river. For years, I didn't say a word about it to anyone. I hoped silence would make it disappear, or turn it into nothing more than an ugly invention of my nasty little mind. But it didn't. It was there, this thing about which I'd wonder, what the fuck was up with that? There was nothing to fuck up with that, and there never will be. I will die with there never being anything to fuck up with my grandfather making my hands do the things he made my hands do with his cock. But it took me years to figure that out, to hold the truth within me that some things are so sad and wrong and unanswerable that the question must simply stand alone like a spear in the mud. So I railed against it in search of the answer to what the fuck was up with my grandfather doing that to me. What the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? But I could never shake it. That particular fuck would not be shook. Asking what the fuck only brought it around. Around and around it went. My grandfather's cock in my hands. The memory of it so vivid, so palpable, so very much a part of me. It came to me during sex and not during sex. It came to me in flashes and it came to me in dreams. It came to me one day when I found a baby bird fallen from a tree. I'd always heard that you're not supposed to pick up baby birds, that once you touch them, their mama won't come back and get them. But it doesn't matter if that's true or not. This bird was a goner anyway. Its neck was broken, its head lolling treacherously to the side. I cradled it as delicately as I could in my palms, cooing to soothe it. But each time I cooed, it only struggled piteously to get away, terrified by my voice. The bird's suffering would have been unbearable for me to witness at any time, but it was particularly unbearable at that moment in my life, because my mother had just died. And because she was dead, I was pretty much dead too. I was dead but alive. And I had a baby bird in my palms that was dead but alive as well. I knew there was only one humane thing to do, though it took me the better part of an hour to work up the courage to do it. I put the baby bird in a paper bag and smothered it with my hands. Nothing that has died in my life has ever died easily, and this bird was no exception. This bird did not go down without a fight. I could feel it through the paper bag, pulsing against my hand and rearing up, simultaneously flaccid and ferocious beneath its translucent sheen of skin, precisely as my grandfather's cock had been. There it was. There it was again. Right there in the paper bag. The ghost of that old man's cock would always be in my hands. But I understood what I was doing this time. I understood that I had to press against it harder than I could bear. It had to die. Pressing harder was murder. It was mercy. That's what the fuck it was. The fuck was mine. And the fuck is yours too, WTF. That question does not apply, quote, to everything every day. If it does, you're wasting your life. If it does, you're a lazy coward. And you are not a lazy coward. Ask better questions, sweet pea. The fuck is your life? Answer it. Yours, sugar. Go, go, go. Dear sugar, I've been playing music, guitar and bass, since I was 11 years old. I've been in the same band since I was 20. I'm now 26 and still living in the same town, still playing the same gigs. I love my band. It's a part of who I am, and we've released an album that I'm proud of, self-produced, but the local kids love it. Still, I wonder what would happen if I left. I want to see other parts of the country, move around, explore before I have a family to take care of. But then again, my band is my family, and I feel I shouldn't abandon them. We're never going to make it big, and that's fine. But am I selfish if I decide to leave? Thanks, sugar. Considering going solo. Dear CGS, go, go, go. You need it one more time, darling? Go. Really, truly, as soon as you can. Of this, I am absolutely sure. Do not reach the era of child rearing and real jobs with a guitar case full of crushing regret for all the things you'd wished you'd done in your youth. I know too many people who didn't do those things. They all end up mingy, addled, shrink-wrapped versions of the people they intended to be. It's hard to go. It's scary and lonely, and your bandmates will have a fit, and half the time you'll be wondering why the hell you're in Cincinnati or Austin or North Dakota or Mongolia or wherever your melodious little finger-plucking hiney takes you. There will be boondoggles and discombobulated days, freaked out nights, and metaphorical flat tires. But it will be soul-smashingly beautiful, solo. It will open up your life. Yours, sugar. The Black Arc of It. Dear sugar, I'm a 38-year-old guy and engaged to be married. My fiancé is 35. I don't need romantic advice. I'm writing to you about my fiancé's mother, who passed away from cancer several years before I met her, when my fiancé was 23. She and her mother were close. Her death was an awful blow to my fiancé at the time, and it still hurts her deeply, It's not like she can't get out of bed or is struggling with depression. She has a great life. One of her friends calls her Joy on Wheels, and that's accurate. But I know it isn't the whole story. Her mom's death is always lurking. It comes up on a regular basis. When she cries or talks about how much she misses her mom, I'm supportive, but I usually feel insufficient. I don't know what to say beyond lame things like, I'm sorry, and I can imagine how you'd feel, though I can't because my mom is still alive. She never had much of a relationship with her dad, who left the picture a long time ago, and she and her sister aren't very close, so I can't rely on someone in her family to be there for her. Sometimes I try to cheer her up or try to get her to forget about the heavy stuff, but that usually backfires and only makes her feel worse. I don't know how to handle this, Sugar. I feel lame in the face of her grief. I know you lost your mother, too. What can you tell me? I want to be a better partner when it comes to handling grief. Signed, Bewildered. Dear Bewildered, several months after my mother died, I found a glass jar of stones tucked in the far reaches of her bedroom closet. I was moving her things out of the house I thought of as home, but that no longer was. It was a devastating process, more brutal in its ruthless clarity than anything I've ever experienced or hoped to again. But when I held that jar of rocks in my hands, I felt a kind of elation I cannot describe in any other way except to say that in the cold clunk of its weight, I felt ever so fleetingly as if I were holding my mother. That jar of stones wasn't just any jar of stones. They were rocks my brother and sister and I had given to our mom. Stones we'd found as kids on beaches and trails and the grassy patches on the edges of parking lots and pressed into her hands. Our mother's palms, the receptacle for every last thing we thought worth saving. I sat down on the bedroom floor and dumped them out, running my fingers over them as if they were the most sacred things on the earth. Most were smooth and black and smaller than a potato chip. Worry stones, my mother had called them, the sort so pleasing against the palm she claimed they had the power to soothe the mind if you rubbed them right. What do you do with the rocks you once gave to your dead mother? Where is their rightful place? To whom do they belong? To what are you obligated? Memory? Practicality? Reason? Faith? Do you put them back in the jar and take them with you across the wild and unkempt sorrow of your 20s? Or do you simply carry them outside and dump them in the yard? I couldn't know. Knowing was so far away. I could only touch the rocks, hoping to find my mother in them. Not long before my mother died, a friend told me a story about a woman she knew, a resident at the group home for those with brain injuries where my friend worked. Several years before, the woman had been attacked as she walked home from a party. Her head hit the sidewalk so hard in the course of the assault that she'd never be the same again. She was incapable of living alone and capable of so very much, and yet she remembered just enough of her former life as a painter and teacher that she was miserable in the group home, and she desperately longed to return to her own house. She refused to accept the explanations given to her as to why she couldn't. She had come to fervently believe that in order to be released, she had only to recite the correct combination of numbers to her captors, her caretakers. 9348021907 2, she'd say, as they fed her and bathed her and helped her get ready for bed. 655-209-1783. 410-684-7508. 0529-856-2347. And on in a merciless spiral. But no matter what she said, she would never crack the code. There was no code. There was only the new fact of her life, changed irrevocably. In the months after my mother died, I thought of this woman an inordinate amount, and not only because I was distressed by her suffering. I thought of her because I understood her monumental desire and her groundless faith. I believed that I could crack a code, too, that my own irrevocably changed life could be redeemed if only I could find the right combination of things. That in those objects, my mother would be given back to me, in some indefinable and figurative way, that would make it okay for me to live the rest of my life without her. And so I searched. I didn't find it in the half-empty container of peppermint Tic Tacs that had been in the glove compartment of my mother's car on the day she died, or in the fringed moccasins that still stank precisely of my mother's size 6 feet a whole year later. I didn't find it in her unfashionably large reading glasses, or the gray porcelain horse that had sat on the shelf near her bed. I didn't find it in her pen from the bank, with the real $100 bill shredded up inside, or in the butter dish with the white marble ball in its top, or in any one of the shirts she'd sewn for herself, or for me. And I didn't find it in those stones either, in spite of my hopes on that sad day. It wasn't anywhere, in anything, and it never would be. "It will never be okay," a friend who lost her mom in her teens said to me a couple years ago. "It will never be okay that our mothers are dead." At the time she said this to me, she wasn't yet really my friend. We'd chatted passingly at parties, but this was the first time we were alone together. She was 50-something, and I was 40. Our moms had been dead for ages. We were both writers with kids of our own now. We had good relationships and fulfilling careers. And yet the unadorned truth of what she'd said, "It will never be okay," entirely unzipped me. It will never be okay. And yet there we were, the two of us more than okay. Both of us happier and luckier than anyone has a right to be. You could describe either one of us as joy on wheels, though there isn't one good thing that has happened to either of us that we haven't experienced through the lens of our grief. I'm not talking about weeping and wailing every day, though sometimes we both did that. I'm talking about what goes on inside, the words unspoken, the shaky quake at the body's core. There was no mother at our college graduations. There was no mother at our weddings. There was no mother when we sold our first books. There was no mother when our children were born. There was no mother ever, at any turn, for either one of us in our entire adult lives. And there never will be. The same is true for your fiancé, bewildered. She is your joy on wheels, whose every experience is informed and altered by the fact that she lost the most essential, elemental, primal, and central person in her life too soon. I know this without knowing her. It will never be okay that she lost her mother. And the kindest, most loving thing you can do for her is to bear witness to that, to muster the strength, courage, and humility it takes to accept the enormous reality of its not okayness and be okay with it the same way she has to be. Get comfortable being the man who says, "Oh, honey, I'm so sorry for your loss," over and over again. That's what the people who have consoled me the most deeply in my sorrow have done. They've spoken those words or something like them every time I needed to hear it. They've plainly acknowledged what is invisible to them, but is so very real to me. I know saying those cliched and ordinary things makes you feel squirmy and lame. I feel that way too when I say such things to others who have lost someone they loved. We all do. It feels lame because we like to think we can solve things. It feels insufficient because there is nothing we can actually do to change what's horribly true. But compassion isn't about solutions. It's about giving all the love that you've got. So give it. It's clear that you've done it already. Your kind letter is proof. But I encourage you to stop being bewildered. Have the guts to feel lame. Say that you're sorry for your lover's loss about 3,000 times over the coming years. Ask about her mother sometimes without her prompting. Console her before she asks to be consoled. Honor her mother on your wedding day and in other ways as occasions arise. Your mother-in-law is dead, but she lives like a shadow mother in the woman you love. Make a place for her in your life, too. That's what Mr. Sugar has done for me. That's what some of my friends and even acquaintances have done. It doesn't make it okay, but it makes it better. It's been more than 20 years since my mother died. So long I squint every time the thought comes to me. So long that I've finally convinced myself There isn't a code to crack. The search is over. The stones I once gave my mother have scattered, replaced by the stones my children give to me. I keep the best ones in my pockets. Sometimes there is one so perfect, I carry it around for weeks, my hand finding it and finding it, soothing itself along the black arc of it. Yours, Sugar. Hell is other people's boyfriends. Dear Sugar, I'm a freshman in high school, and everyone knows how high school is. Drama, drama, drama. And my best friend, let's say her name is Jill, is at the center of it. See, Jill's dating this guy, let's call him Jack, who has a girlfriend who goes to another school. As Jill's best friend, I already don't like Jack. He doesn't want to break up with the girlfriend for Jill. He and his girlfriend have been together over a year. But in my opinion, the situation is unacceptable. Jack seems like a nice guy, but there's that underlying scumbag quality that I just can't get past. It's obvious that Jack really likes Jill, but he just won't drop the girlfriend or Jill. I don't know which way I want it to go. On the one hand, I want Jill to be happy, so I want Jack to break up with the girlfriend. On the other hand, I want to punch Jack in the face, and I think he would do the exact same thing to Jill that he's doing to his girlfriend. I've been thinking about having a talk with Jack, but I'm not sure if that would help the situation. Sugar, how do I make at least one of them see the light and realize that what they're doing is wrong? Worried friend. Dear worried friend, drama, drama, drama indeed. Oh, but this one's easy, sweet pea, and hard. But best to learn it now, since as a freshman in high school, you're only at the very beginning of these sorts of hijinks. Jean-Paul Sartre famously said that hell is other people, which is true enough. But truer still is hell is other people's boyfriends, or girlfriends, as the case may be. I've been witness to those I care about cheating and being cheated on, lying and being lied to, emotionally abusing and being emotionally abused by their lovers. I've consoled and counseled. I've listened to long and tedious tales of spectacularly disastrous romantic woe that I predicted from the start because that same friend chose the same wrong person yet a fucking again. But the sad news is that this is the way of the world, darling, and there isn't a ding-dang damn thing you can do about it. Have you read Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet yet? People die because they want who they want. They do all kinds of crazy, stupid, sweet, tender, amazing, self-destructive things. You aren't going to make anyone, quote, see the light and realize that what they're doing is wrong. You just aren't. And you shouldn't even try. What's happening between Jack and Jill is between Jack and Jill. Jill knows that Jack is involved with someone else. She chooses to be in a romantic relationship with him anyway. Jack chooses to deceive a young woman he presumably cares for and string along another. These are not pretty things, but they are true things. Don't get me wrong. I sympathize. I know I sound calm and collected, but the truth is I rather regularly come at least internally unglued over some buffoon or scoundrel that one or the other of my intimates have deemed to love. See, hell is other people's boyfriends. It's dreadful to watch a friend make choices that you fear will cause her pain. But this is where boundaries come in, my dear worried friend. Do you know what boundaries are? The best, sanest people on the planet do. And since I have no doubt that you will become one of those sorts of people, you might as well learn about them sooner rather than later. This little pickle with Jack and Jill and the young woman at the other school has given you just that opportunity. It's clear to me that the emotions that have arisen in your concern for Jill and your subsequent dislike of Jack have blurred your ability to understand appropriate boundaries. Your impulse to swoop in and set these lovebirds straight tells me that you're overestimating your power and influence, and you're also disrespecting Jill's right to romantic self-determination, which she absolutely has, no matter how maddening her decisions may be to you. This isn't to say you should remain silent. Another thing that the best, sanest people on the planet do is they have the guts to tell the truth. You should tell Jill what you told me, that you want her to be happy, but because Jack is a two-timing tomcat, you fear he will someday treat her the way he is treating his other, quote, real girlfriend. Listen to what she says with an open heart and a critical mind. Love her even if she doesn't do what you hope she does once you point out the fact that her paramour is a scumbag. Wish her the best without getting yourself emotionally tangled up in a situation that has nothing to do with you. Remember those boundaries? Her life is not yours, yours is not hers, etc. And then, worried friend, just let whatever happens between Jack and Jill happen. Laugh if they end up proving you wrong. Be there for Jill if you got it right. And in the meanwhile, cultivate an understanding of a bunch of the other things that the best, sanest people on the planet know. That life is long. That people both change and remain the same. That every last one of us will need to fuck up and be forgiven. That we're all just walking and walking and walking and trying to find our way. That all roads lead eventually to the mountaintop. Yours, Sugar. Thwack, thwack, thwack. Dear Sugar, 2 days ago my boss let me out of my shift early. I tried calling my boyfriend on the phone, but he didn't answer. When I got home and opened the door to our apartment, I found him standing in front of our full-length mirror in my panties. He slammed the door shut and locked it before I registered what I saw. I was surprised, sure, but I was more surprised that when he opened the door back up, fully dressed, in his own clothes, he acted as though it never happened. We've always had an open and fun relationship, both sexually and emotionally, so I was thrown by this secretive behavior. I've always showed willingness and interest in experimentation. I can't understand why he'd keep this from me. Should I say something to him, or better yet, do something to show that I'm not turned off? Or do I continue to follow his lead and say nothing at all? Yours, sharing panties, but not fantasies. Dear SPBNF, the first time Mr. Sugar spanked me, we'd been lovers for a week. By then, we'd fucked so hard, so often, so enthrallingly and excellently and shatteringly that the heat of what lived between us practically scorched the paint off the walls. I was jammed up against the bathroom sink, and he was jammed up against me, both of us facing the mirror. I saw how his expression went serious and studied and a little bit hard the moment before that first thwack. "You like that, baby?" he whispered into my hair, and I made a little moan of assent. Thwack, thwack, thwack. I didn't actually like it all that much, baby, but neither was I opposed to it. He was such a stellar man, such a stunningly adept lover, so unlike anyone I'd ever met, and so profoundly much like the best, most secret parts of me, that I was willing to put up with a mildly battered bum if that's what got him off. The thought of him being aroused by spanking me was more than enough to convince me to play along that first time as we worked our way hotly down the sink's white porcelain pedestal to the dank underworld beneath, where we finally went still on the cream-colored vinyl floor among the grimy silver pipes, wondering exactly how we got there, so exquisitely spent that it didn't matter. "Did you know your sink was made in Argentina?" I asked when I was able to speak. "Argentina?" he replied. By way of answer, I reached up and ran my finger over the tiny sticker on the bottom of his sink that said, "Made in Argentina." "That was fun," he said, "wasn't it?" "It was," I said. "Really fun." Thwack, 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 we went, all through the next month. "You like that baby, don't you?" "Yeah, thwack." After a while, in spite of everything, I grew the slightest bit annoyed. His timing often threw me off my own little pleasure ride. His hand occasionally landed painfully on my tailbone instead of the fleshy bottom of my rump. "Can you please hit me lower?" I once snapped so sharply in the middle of the act that I ruined the mood and we had to stop. "What turns you on about spanking me?" I finally asked him. "It's sexy," he said with a nonchalant air. "But what's sexy about it to you?" I pressed. "That it turns you on so much," he answered. "That it turns me on so much?" I replied. "Yeah," he said, and his eyes met mine. It didn't take anything more than that. The way our eyes locked, we both understood in a flash that we'd been acting out our own pornographic The Gift of the Magi, each of us making a sacrifice that nullified the gift of the other. I no more wanted to be spanked than I wanted to fuck a kangaroo, and vice versa. We were doing it because we thought that's what the other one wanted to do. After we stopped laughing, we traced it back, how we'd come to this misunderstanding. Turns out I'd made a comment on something like day 3 of our relationship that had to do with sex and control and submission and domination, tenderness and surrender, and the social construct of gender and desire and incest and transgression and masculinity and power, and a teenage fantasy I'd had that involved the Super Bowl and a bunch of men in business suits. And he took it to mean that I wanted to be punished like a naughty girl in a nunnery, so he spanked the mother-loving breath out of me for a month.
Isn't that the sweetest thing you ever heard?
Actually, I said, spanking doesn't do a thing for me.
What does? He asked.
And that is where we began nearly 15 years ago, with his question followed by my answer, with my question followed by his. It was how we proceeded. Not on the heat so powerful that it might possibly scorch the paint off the walls, but with the sturdier, this is scary but let's do it anyway nerve that it took to say what was true, not just about ourselves, but about our sexual selves. Which sometimes oddly, sometimes thrillingly, sometimes amusingly, sometimes darkly, sometimes depressingly, turns out to not be terribly much like the sexual selves we'd choose if we got to choose them. There is no question that your lover is embarrassed about the fact that he likes to wear women's panties. Who wouldn't be? What man would ask for such a thing? This isn't to say he can't cozy up to the idea, and I sincerely hope for his own sake that he will. But it's clear he isn't there yet. He's ashamed of it. Very likely he loathes it. And yet there it is, and he can't deny it. And so one day, when he's got the place to himself, he caves in and strips himself down and dresses himself up, and without warning, you appear. You, his emotionally and experimentally open lover. And he slams the door in your face and pretends it never happened. You know why? Because no matter how experimental he is, his life isn't an experiment. His life is like your life and my life and all the lives of all the people who are reading these words right now. It's a roiling stew of fear and need and desire and love and the hunger to be loved. And mostly, it's the latter. You walked in on him at what he perceives as his most unlovable moment, the pervert in the girly underpants. You saw his secret self before he told you his secret, and that humiliates him beyond words. There is no going back. You can't unwalk in on him. You have to address what you saw, but I don't think it's a good idea for you to do something to demonstrate that you're not turned off. You need to talk to him, honey bun. It's going to be scary and awkward, but you can do it. When I have something to say that's particularly hard to say, I often write it down first. If what happened to you happened to me, I'd write, I want to talk to you about that day I came home from work early. I'm nervous about having this conversation, but I care about you, and our relationship is important enough to me that I'm willing to risk feeling uncomfortable. First and foremost, I want you to know that I don't judge you for what I saw. In fact, I'm intrigued. When I opened the door and saw you standing there in my underwear, I was surprised because I thought you'd been open with me about your sexuality and desires. But I was far more surprised that you shut the door and didn't discuss it with me later. It's been bothering me because I want you to trust that you can be honest with me, and also because I want to be intimate with you. And I don't think we can do so with this silence about what happened that day between us. Will you talk to me about it? If he says no, your relationship is dead, though you may continue to fake it for a while. If he says yes, that is the place from which you will proceed. It's a real place, an underworld place, a place where we are all spent and crouched among the pipes, fingering the foreign and covert origins of our most primal desires. While you're down there with your guy, I suggest you share some things of your own. Give him a peek at whatever would make you slam the door shut if he walked in and caught you in front of the mirror. That Made in Argentina sticker isn't under the bathroom sink anymore. We don't even live in the house with that bathroom sink. Before we moved out, years after we first became lovers. Mr. Sugar meticulously peeled the sticker off, and with it, he made a card. Made in Argentina, it says on the front. Inside he wrote,